Welcome to the Singular Links podcast. I'm Tony Parrish, a.k.a. Slinker. In this episode, we explore transformation by expansion, how small, ordinary units, when carefully assembled, can give rise to something entirely new. This episode follows the artist Chuck Close and shows how constraint, repetition, and aggregation can become engines of reinvention. Rather than breaking things down to their smallest parts, this chapter looks at what happens when simple elements are multiplied, arranged, and viewed from the right distance. As you listen, consider how scale, perspective, and assembly can change not just what you see, but what becomes possible. This is chapter 5 of the book Singular Links. I hope you enjoy Transformation by Expansion. Transformation by Expansion. I was back in New York recently and made a stop at the East 86th Street subway station. Tucked into the walls there are Chuck Close's mosaics, giant portraits staring at commuters and shimmering in tile and glass. They are a fitting tribute to an artist whose life's work was obsessed with faces, even though he struggled to recognize them. Close had dyslexia and prosopagnosia, or face blindness. Yet he advanced to the forefront of the avant-garde by painting faces with meticulous precision. In the 1980s, his photorealistic canvases were landmarks. Then, at 48, at the pinnacle of the art world, his body failed him. Overnight, he became a quadriplegic. I want to rewind to early 1989, to the time when Close was struggling to rehabilitate at the Rusk Institute. What unfolded was a story of an artist confronting physical and creative limitations, searching for a way back to work, and turning paralysis into a catalyst for reinvention. During the first month at Rusk, Close sank into despair. Out of the blue, he had suffered a spinal artery collapse, a rare event that left him with almost no movement from the neck down. Without the ability to make art, he could not live the life that had defined him for decades. He worried about his family and about losing his ability to provide. He was nearly completely immobile, watching muscles waste away, noticing even the hollow forming between his thumb and forefinger. Noticing that kind of detail had once been his power. Now it was evidence of what was slipping away. The unraveling had begun 2 months earlier, in December 1988, when he experienced what he referred to as the event. Close had just presented an award at Gracie Mansion. Instead of returning to his seat, he staggered out, crossed the street, and admitted himself to Doctor's Hospital with the help of a policeman. The pain in his chest and arms was severe. Doctors assumed a heart attack, pain medicine, tests. His wife Leslie rushed to his side. Soon his body convulsed, then went still. He remained conscious through it all, aware even as his lungs failed and his muscles shut down. He was paralyzed. His diaphragm stopped functioning, his breathing sustained only by constant intervention. Strangely, amid this chaos, Close felt a kind of calm. He later compared it to the eerie stillness of a car crash. Time slows, instincts take over, and fear does not grow. Only afterwards does the weight of it all settle in. Now, at Rusk, he carried a single ambition. I just want to paint again. Ever since childhood, painting had been his motivation. It had given him purpose once, and now it could possibly provide purpose again, not just as art, but as rehabilitation itself. Rehabilitation exposed all the obstacles between Close and a blank canvas. He could not walk, which meant no crouching to reach the bottom of a canvas, and no stretching to reach the top. Large-scale painting had always required gallons of paint and mineral spirits, careful preparation, and many tasks that now seemed impossible. His hands, once trained to mix subtle shades with the flick of a wrist, barely moved at all. For a time, he imagined himself reduced to an idea man, conceiving works for others to execute. But that thought crushed him. What he loved was the physicality of painting, the drag of the brush, the rhythm of the body in motion. His paralysis caused by a blood clot at the C3 vertebra just below the skull left him with little more than head movement. He even considered improbable workarounds, painting with a brush clenched in his teeth or spitting paint onto canvas. The longing to paint never left. At Rusk, where he had his own room, Close began to test limits. His rehab had two elements, therapy by day, visitors by evening. Friends dropped in, drank beverages from his fridge, filled the place with chatter until nurses told them to quiet down. Close insisted the activity and socializing helped his recovery. His physical therapist, Meg, did not generally approve of him drinking alcohol during his rehab, but she made him a promise. If he managed to paint again, she would take him out to get good and drunk to celebrate. Visitors reminded him that painting was not in his limbs, it was in his mind. He still had his eyes and his imagination, and he knew how to make art. That reminder lit a fire. As a clumsy, dyslexic teenager, he had found in painting a place where he could focus, excel, and feel whole. Now it offered him the same lifeline, a way back to himself. The obstacles remained significant. He could not reach canvases the way he once had, so Meg built him a wheelchair-accessible easel that adjusted to his range of motion. He could not prep his material, so staff mixed and poured them for him. The hardest challenge of all was the brush itself. His hands, numb as if plunged into ice water, could not grip. The solution was improvisation. They strapped the brush to his hand, guided it to the palette, and pushed color across the canvas again, stroke by stroke. Close began to shrink the problem down to something he could manage. If he could not command a massive canvas, as he once did, maybe he could command a tiny square. A 2-inch patch could be its own painting, one square at a time, square by square. He imagined mounting these small panels with Velcro, letting an assistant assemble them into a larger whole, like a jigsaw puzzle of color and form. At first, the work left him drained. He tired quickly, his arms sagging back into his lap. His assistant strapped a crude brace to his wrist, and Close worked out a sequence. Lift the brush with both hands, grip it briefly with his teeth, slide it into the Velcro slot of the brace. Awkward, slow, imperfect, yet eventually he was painting again. The larger question hovered. What could he accomplish with his paralysis? He wasn't sure. What mattered was that each week he could hold out a little longer. Where once his arms collapsed after a few strokes, he now steadied them by locking both hands together and finding ways to stabilize the brush. The progress was incremental, but unmistakable. He was learning, square by square, how to make painting possible again. 7 months after arriving at Rusk, and 9 months after the event, Close was discharged. His doctors had urged him to stay longer, but his therapist recognized that daily gains were leveling off. He had regained some mobility, yet the wheelchair would be permanent. Still, what mattered to him was getting home. As promised, Meg took him out to get good and drunk, and then he was discharged. Leslie had already remodeled their country house to accommodate his new lifestyle. His studio was reworked with a movable easel, and assistants stepped in to handle tasks he could no longer do alone, laying out the grid on the canvas, mixing paints, washing brushes, keeping the process flowing. His mechanics had changed, but the studio was alive again, and Close was back where he wanted to be, in front of the canvas. The first painting he tackled after leaving Rusk was a portrait of Alex Katz, titled Alex 2. Naturally, it was very different from his previous work. For one, its color palette was different from his older portraits. It was brighter, more saturated than anything he had done in years, almost cheerful. He later said, "I felt things were going to be all right." That was reflected in the colors. The roots of his post-event change go back to Close's early career. As a young painter, he idolized the abstract expressionist painter Willem de Kooning and embraced vibrant color and expressive brushwork. When he moved from abstraction to photorealism, he stripped down his palette to the three primary colors, red, yellow, and blue, and pursued meticulous, almost industrial precision. At Rusk, surrounded by the gray hospital walls, he rediscovered the vivid colors of his youth, and Alex, too, emerged alive with that energy. Before the paralyzing event, Close had already been experimenting with shifts in style. In the portraits he made of his artist friends Francesco Clemente and Cindy Sherman, for instance, he had begun to dissolve the subject, allowing the image to fracture into more pronounced, painterly marks. These experiments were subtle accents to his rigorous photorealism. The paralyzing incident, however, forced him to accelerate that evolution because of his limited control. He no longer possessed the dexterity to refine every detail. Reflecting back on the Clemente painting, he noticed that his style had already begun to evolve. The grid remained the foundation of his work, but his approach had changed. Where he once relied on seamless control, he now adapted to the limits of his body, using brushes strapped to his hand, arms stabilized, and movements tentative but deliberate. The process became a collaboration with himself and his assistants, a careful choreography of hands, arms, and teeth. Looking at his portraits before 1988, the artist's technique remained in the background of the work, and the subject commanded attention. The portraits felt photographic at every distance. After 1988, however, the balance shifted. From afar, the subject emerged clearly, but up close, the surface exploded into messy, tactile marks, smears, streaks, and dabs of uneven color. Each small square, roughly the size of a post-it note, became its own abstract unit. Viewed alone, chaotic. Viewed together, cohesive. Lavender blended into gray, brown streaked with orange, black flecks punctuated dark fields. The viewer's eye stitched the fragments into likeness. The event forced Close to accept imperfection, to let go of absolute control, and to let his hand be visible in every stroke. Precision gave way to expression, photographic illusion to painterly presence. The work began to oscillate between recognition and dissolution, subject and artist. In a sense, painting saved Chuck Close twice. First, as a teenager, when dyslexia and clumsiness left few outlets, and again after 1988 as a way to reclaim purpose and reassert his identity. When Leslie first saw Alex II, she cried. The painting captured both recovery and reinvention. The work was purchased by MoMA in New York, cementing its place as a milestone in Close's extraordinary journey. From Dots to Faces, the Art of Expansion. Up close, the paintings of Chuck Close looked like swarms of color fragments. Step back, and suddenly a vivid face emerges, alive with detail. That simple shift in perspective holds a lesson for innovators everywhere. I call it transformation by expansion. The idea is simple. Small, ordinary units, when linked together in certain ways, can do more than just enlarge the whole. They can transform it. Whereas Claude Shannon's transformation by reduction deconstructs things to their atomic units, transformation by expansion merges multiple units to make a larger thing. Reduction focuses on the micro, expansion on the macro. After being paralyzed, Close adapted his technique, focusing on small individual squares on the canvas. Each post-it size blotch looks chaotic, but arranged side by side in a grid, the squares interact with one another, building towards something new. Step back, and the clusters resolve into a face so vivid and lifelike you might expect the eyes to blink. Expression emerges from seeming chaos, a human presence transformed by the arrangement of ordinary units. You can see countless examples of transformation through expansion in the natural world. Bees repeat a hexagonal pattern until a honeycomb forms. Snowflakes emerge from water molecules, arranging themselves into fractal geometry. Coral reefs balloon when billions of polyps layer their secretions upon one another, growing into something that is even visible from space. Even our brains are mosaics of repeated units. A single neuron fires a pulse, but trillions together generate memory, imagination, and consciousness. Each unit on its own is basic, even dull. But when multiplied and combined, they may become something astonishing. Emergence is a recurring pattern in the universe. Capital markets run on the same principle. Here, the singular links aren't painted squares, but buyers and sellers, each acting on self-interest and limited perspective. Alone, a single buyer's decision is trivial. But when millions interact in the marketplace, they create something far more powerful. They create price discovery. Francis Galton, a statistician in the early 1900s, chronicled a contest where people guessed the weight of an ox. No single person guessed exactly right, even among farmers, butchers, and other experts. But when Galton averaged all the guesses together, the result was shockingly close to the animal's actual weight. The crowd, as a whole, was smarter than any individual expert. Transition by expansion is seen in the wisdom of the crowd. That's a prototype of how markets function. Each buyer and seller brings limited knowledge, hunches, and biases. But when all those decisions are combined, the result is an emergent consensus, the price of a stock, bond, or asset at any given moment. This is the essence of the efficient market hypothesis. The idea that prices reflect all available public information. Truth in markets doesn't come from a single genius, but from the unintended cooperation of many. What looks like noise in isolation becomes insight in combination. Coming back to the art world, I remember standing in a museum staring at La Grande Jatte, the famous 19th century painting by pointillist painter George Seurat, depicting Parisians in a park wearing humped skirts and carrying parasols. Up close, all I saw were tiny colored flecks. Five steps back, and the park came into focus, with trees, dogs, and sunbathers, all conjured from dots. This is transformation by expansion. Roy Lichtenstein pulled a similar trick a century later. His giant canvases mimic comic book panels. From across the room, they look clean and sharp, as if lifted straight from a graphic novel. Step closer, and the illusion falls apart. The images are built from clusters of Bende dots. Up close, nothing but dots. Far away, a whole scene. Expansion becomes transformation. And then there's Close himself. After his catastrophic event, he could no longer paint with the same fine motor control. For most artists, that might have been the end. But Close adapted. He adopted a cruder style, larger marks, rougher blotches of paint. Strangely, the portraits gained something new. They became less mechanical, more expressive. In general, larger units tend towards crudeness. If you have just three big dots on a canvas, your options are limited. By contrast, if you have hundreds of dots, you can create more subtlety. The paradox of Close's later work is that by embracing larger, clumsier building blocks, he found new forms of subtlety. The portraits breathed in ways his earlier work didn't. Close himself reflected on this process. In conversation with Charlie Rose, he described the difference between painting and photography. "Photography happens all at once," he said. "A painting, on the other hand, is always unfinished until it's finished. You have the chance to see how each thing that you add to what's already there changes what you have and anticipates what you're going to do next. Although he worked on one square at a time, Close would make multiple passes over the whole large canvas from top to bottom, over and over again, for several months. He would start by drawing a grid on his canvas, and during the first pass, he would fill each square with a color chosen arbitrarily. The purpose was to create something that he would react to later when he revisited that section during the second and third passes. He summarized, "In this series of two or three or four correcting moves, I'll try and move it from this color that's wrong to something that reads the way I want." He compared this process to the way a golfer moves the ball from the tee to the hole. Golf is the only sport that moves from general to specific in an ideal number of correcting moves, he observed. The first stroke is just out there. The second one corrects that. The third one corrects that. Eventually, you place the ball in this very specific 3.5-inch diameter circle, which you found by walking through the landscape. Close's process unfolded in the same way, changing each square from some arbitrary cube of color to a specific puzzle piece within a larger image. Transformation by expansion. Close's paintings remind us that the unit itself doesn't matter much. A single square of color, a dot, a pixel, a neuron, a guess at the weight of an ox. On its own, each is ordinary, but assembled in the right way, something emerges. Markets find prices. Brains produce thought. Paint swarms to become faces. Small units carefully linked generate new results. That's one of the lessons of singular links. It's not just the pieces you have, but also how you connect them. Close's work highlights the power of assembly. His canvases are unions of individuals. What looks like chaos up close can form an ordered whole from afar. The same principle applies across art, nature, technology, and other domains. Mosaics comprised of ceramic shards, rhythms built from single drum beats, video games rendered with glowing pixels. In every case, the individual unit is dumb, but arranged with intention, the units generate meaning. Close's paintings are also an exercise in holism. The whole is more than the sum of its parts and must be seen in its entirety. The world is not just a collection of parts, it's a web of connections. Each one is a node in a cohesive network. Another lesson is the relationship between chaos and order. Up close, the squares look like chaotic blotches. But what looks like chaos at one level forms an astonishing ordered whole at another. Meaning doesn't always come from perfect order. Sometimes it emerges from organized chaos. Close's work shows that the same object can be both mundane and extraordinary, depending on the scale of observation. Meaning grows by shifting perspective. And maybe that's why Close's work resonates with so many people. His canvases are mosaics of painted squares, but they point to something larger. Life itself is emergent. We are not one thing, but many things woven together. Cells, neurons, trades, dots, squares, life choices. Step back far enough, and meaning appears. Step too close, and it dissolves again. The transformation lies in the shifting perspective. Transformation by expansion. That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to explore more ideas like this, you can find much, much more at singularlinks.com. If you're feeling frisky, tell your friends and family, in-laws and outlaws. Music was provided by the Slink Tones. Until next time, connect the unconnected, create the unexpected.